Does it work? Okay, this is Rob.
You have to talk to these things so they feel connected with you.
Thanks. Thank you, Peter. Hello, good evening. Welcome to Christ Church Cathedral. I'm one of the priests here, so I guess this is the official Christ Church Cathedral welcome, and my name is Rob Rhodes. Glad to see you here tonight. I don't know how I got to be the only person who got to do this twice, but I'll try not to take advantage of you, and I will be repeating almost nothing from if you were here when I spoke last time. There won't be a whole lot of repeat of what I talked about last time. Tonight's going to be a lot more personal. I was not always Episcopalian, and I found my way into the Episcopal Church 1990. And that was at Christ Church Cathedral in St. Louis. And I noticed on the bulletin, you know, when you go into a church or other house of worship, you'll have some sort of service thing that guides you through the service. And in the bulletin there, they had on their, as their mission statement, learning to sing the Lord's song in a strange land. That was the mission of Christ Church Cathedral in St. Louis, which was really a powerful thing for me. And that came from Psalm 137. That's probably smart. Because,
yeah. If you're going to move,
I'm going
to change my technology.
Try to stay awake. Psalm 137, and so more fully, at least the first four verses go like this. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, and there we wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows, there were hung up our harps. For there our captors asked us for songs, and our tormentors asked for mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How could we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? This is going to be the thing that kind of, the lens through which I speak tonight when I tell my story. But there was something else that happened at the cathedral there. Michael Allen was the dean of the cathedral. When I came into the church there, he's a powerful personality. He's one of those guys who, you know, got arrested in, you know, civil rights marches and went to Vietnam with Joan Baez. I have a picture of him upstairs with him and Joan Baez. Just a powerful personality. And one of the things that he would ask someone who was going to be baptized was, what is it you hope to be liberated from? You know, baptism, in part at least, is kind of going through the waters of the Red Sea. And so he said, if you're leaving Egypt and you're going to the Promised Land, you should know what it is that you're leaving. So you can leave it. And so these are the two things. Learning to sing the Lord's song in a strange land, and what is it you hope to be liberated from, that I want to move around as I tell you, and I hope this isn't too self-indulgent, as I tell you, some of my family's story. I grew up in a working class neighborhood in St. Louis. My dad was a factory worker, assembly plant at Chrysler, which was a great job. But that's not, you know, that's not what he grew up with, and that's not what my mom grew up with. My mom grew up in housing projects in St. Louis. Her father died when she was very young. She was the second of four kids, three girls, one boy. And when my grandfather died, my grandmother couldn't figure out how to make things work. She worked all the time, but there was just not enough money. So they lived in housing projects. Clothes, you know, were kind of not great clothes, even in the housing projects. The kids sort of made fun of what they wore and that kind of thing. I don't think they ever went to bed hungry, but they were always worried that that was going to happen. Sometimes my grandmother would decide not to eat, so the kids would have something. Sometimes a meal was something like a mustard sandwich, you know, just a mustard slapped on bread, and that's the sandwich. There was always a kind of fear about food and about, you know, what they were going to wear and where things were going to come from. You know, Christmas was, if they were lucky, you know, some fruit and some candy and maybe a toy that the three girls could share. That was sort of their life. That's where they came from. I was reminded of all this, actually, because she was just here, she and my stepdad came to help fix some stairs, back stairs, on the house that Debbie and I live in, that we own. And she was telling Debbie this story, because Debbie hadn't really heard much of the stuff I told her son. And as she was telling it, I remember, and I was kind of surprised that she did this, because I'd heard the story a lot, but, you know, she started crying while she was telling it. And part of it was, it's a sad story, and just those memories. But part of it, I don't know if you remember this, like, I was asking, like, why are you crying? And she was saying that it was kind of a shameful thing to grow up that way. It was a painful and shameful thing to grow up that way. And I didn't totally understand that, but I'm going to come back to that in a bit, because I think I have an idea of what she's talking about. Because it was it was a particularly hard life, and in, as she describes it, a kind of a shameful life, they wanted, the girls especially, wanted to not be burdens on their mom, on my grandmother. And so they got married as early as they could. My oldest aunt, the oldest of the three girls, got married when she was 16, so she could get out of the house. And then my mom and her sister each got married when they were 18. Again, let's, you know, just get out of here and give my grandmother a break. My uncle, Uncle Jerry, he got drafted and went to Vietnam, which is another way to not be a burden, but they all got out of there. But that gives you an idea. So, my dad moved to St. Louis from California when his mother, my grandmother, got divorced, and she brought him and his younger brother, my older uncle, got to stay in California. They weren't doing as badly as my mom, but they weren't doing great either. Same again, this kind of, you know, relatively poor neighborhood. They didn't live in the projects, but it was still a pretty poor neighborhood. My dad was drafted also. He did not, thank God, go to Vietnam. He was an artist, a real artist. He still is an artist. And so they use that talent to sort of paint pictures and of various kinds, you know, some propaganda kind of stuff and some other kind of stuff, but it kept him from going to Vietnam. But when he got out of the Army, he had some GI Bill money, and he got a couple years of college. He was doing commercial art. But when my mom got pregnant, he needed money. He needed to take care of the family. And there was a job at the Chrysler plant just outside of St. Louis, and that's what he did. So he gave up, like, a lot of hope for what he wanted to do as a commercial artist and a painter to take care of his family. Now, that job was, you know, it had its issues. He worked late. He worked the graveyard shift for a lot of years. It kind of moved up. There were a lot of demanding hours, but it was also a really good job. It was a union job, exactly. It was UAW. And it was a great job for him, and it meant a lot of things for my family that they might not otherwise have had. It meant that my mom could stay home with us when she wanted to, and so I don't remember a time when my mom wasn't around, which is a great gift. We never had to worry about doctors and dentists. We could just go, and, you know, it costs a little bit, not much. There's always food. I'll tell you, we had more food than any of my friends had, I think because of where my mom came from. The pantry was just full. She never wanted to have to worry about that stuff again. And to this day, she lives in kind of an exurb of St. Louis, Festus, Missouri, and you can go to the cupboard now, and, you know, you can eat for, if you know, if a bomb dropped or whatever, a zombie apocalypse, there's going to be food for a while. You don't need to worry about anything. It was always food. I never thought about food. Christmas, unlike my mom's Christmas, we had way more stuff under that tree than any kid should have. Like I said, my dad, you know, had to work complicated hours at first, but that changed. And he, you know, when he worked overtime, he would get double, and when he worked holidays, he'd get triple pay. So it was a good deal. And it was just a really secure and stable childhood. We didn't have everything we wanted, but we had everything we needed. And we never really worried about whether we would have it. And everybody in the neighborhood had union jobs. All my family had union jobs. And so the neighborhood was also stable. That made a difference. And there, because you didn't have to have both parents working, you could, but you didn't have to, then things like the local, the PTA and all this, that worked, it just worked better. It was a real neighborhood, and it worked really well. The tax base was strong, families were strong, neighborhoods were strong. So in a generation, there was this kind of transformation, certainly for my family, and I think for a lot of families in that time. I was born in 1968, so that'll set the time for what we're talking about. And I got to say, I grew up taking this for granted, at least in my early childhood. It's the way the world worked. You could work hard, this is what I saw in my neighborhood, you could work hard, and you could have a secure life. And that's what I grew up with. Now, union jobs were great, but we should be clear, they did not just appear. Unions didn't just appear, that kind of the stuff that came with unions didn't just appear, and it wasn't just some folks on the corporate, some big corporate level saying, here, have some benefits. I'm not telling you a story you don't know. They fought for those. They fought for them in a lot of ways, sometimes bloody, sometimes people died. And just as those kind of wages and those kind of rights and those kind of benefits can be fought for and gained, they can be taken away. And in fact, they're always under attack. I just got to speak a couple days ago about the idea of right to work and why it's so-called right to work, why it's wrong. I think they're always going to be under attack as long as the people who work are selling the fruits of their labor instead of owning them. And that's a whole other topic, but that's not what we're talking about tonight. But that, I think that's just the way it is. But also, if they can be gained, they can be lost. And that's really what happened, certainly in my family. Those jobs did not stay around for a variety of reasons. And without getting too political, I mean, it's Reagan and NAFTA. I don't know if you need any other words to help describe what happened. Those jobs disappeared. Unions became very weak. We all know this. By the time my generation got to be my parents' age, the landscape was very different. Very different. Most of my generation of my family is now doing much worse than my parents did. We're not living the way they lived. We're not living the way we grew up. I'm blessed. I was lucky. I got to go to college, although I got a lot of student loan debt for college, a lot. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But most of the folks in my generation, in my family, there are none of those kinds of jobs. My family has, much lower paying jobs than they had. Benefits are limited or non-existent. It's just not the way it was when there were union jobs. And again, if this were another talk, I would make a big plug for union jobs. But that's not the point I want to make right now. The point I want to make right now is that for a variety of reasons, working class people are in a worse place today than they were just a generation ago. My stepsister and I were the only two people in my family to get to go to college and earn 4-year degrees and then go on to graduate work. I was a fine arts major at a little Catholic college in St. Louis. It's now a university, but I don't think it's much bigger than it was when I was there. What that meant for me, as I said, was lots of student loans. So that by the time I graduated with a Bachelor of Fine Arts, which you know what kind of money you're going to make with a Bachelor of Fine Arts, I had racked up a bunch of debt. And so even though the first full-time job I got was probably technically considered a white-collar job, it was in the Medical Library of Washington University, and I was making $12,000 a year. I got 4 weeks vacation. I couldn't afford to go anywhere, but I was making $12,000 a year, a staycation. Yes, exactly. But I, you know, I had a couple hundred bucks of student loan debt to pay every month at $1,000, and I had to pay rent, and I had to get food. I mean, you know, that was not the way my parents were even, you know, I grew up. And you know, part of it was like, so, you know, what's this mean? This is supposed to be better, not worse. You know, I couldn't make that. It was $12,000 in 1990. And it was really, I mean, paycheck to paycheck, not even. You can't make it on that. I was aware of that. And, you know, my parents were okay, but they didn't have a bunch of extra to give me. You know, they couldn't really help outside of, you know, sort of moral support. So I had to make it on that, and it felt wrong, because you're supposed to do better than the previous generation. That's what we were told, and that's what had happened. I mean, for decades, that's how it had worked. And college was supposed to help you do better. And again, I was the first person, so, you know. So maybe it shouldn't be a surprise that when the first credit card offer came, I'm like, oh, this is free money. Like, I need this. Like, and I'm not just like, I want to go like crazy with it. Like, I just need it. Seemed like free money. And you know, I guess, like, I look back now and I wonder, like, why would someone making $12,000 a year get a credit card offer? I mean, that's crazy. But
they knew you wouldn't get that.
They knew, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, Richard Wolff says that the banks just kept making credit easier and easier to get. And the way he describes it is, it's they gave credit instead of increasing wages. Right? So it makes us feel like we're doing better than we are. And so it could keep the economy looking like it was moving. And for some people, it was moving. But for working class people, the wages stayed the same at best. And the way that we felt like we were doing better was we got more and more credit. I moved up a little. I worked really hard. I was my father's son, and even though I was in a library, I worked like really hard, and so I kind of moved up a little bit. But when I was still making less than $20,000 a year, I remember getting a credit card offer for $10,000 worth of credit limit, and I was making $20,000 a year. And I remember, even at the time, as much as I would have wanted that free money, I said, "This is crazy. Like, do they even know who I am?" And I think that was one of the things that kind of woke me up. I said, this just doesn't make sense. But, you know, you can only do that kind of thing, and you can only make that work for so long. There's a point at which the bills get higher than even with the credit, than you actually can afford to pay. There was a point at which I had more bills than I had a paycheck. And then, you know, it starts... The feeling starts to rise. It's just shame. I've screwed this up. I had a chance. I went to college. My family, like, you know, sacrificed to get me to college. I have all this debt, and I have messed this up. Which is what you're supposed to think when that happens. That's the way it's designed. I remember in my first parish. And this happened almost right away when I was ordained. Someone came to talk to me, a pastoral conversation, about she thought she might have cancer. They weren't sure. But she wanted to talk to me about it. And she said, the whole thing, listed all the ways that she had been good in her life, and all, you know, all how everything had been going well for her, and she was trying to do her best, and why would God let this happen, right? You know, anybody in pastoral, they've heard these conversations, and I've heard it, you know, since. But most of us sitting here, when we're not in the middle of it, we know that's not right. That's not the way you think about it. You know, the people who are sick shouldn't feel like they've done something wrong to get sick. I guess I want to raise the question, like, people who are in a situation sort of like mine and who've messed up are in kind of the same thing, right? So we will tell the person who's sick, of course, that's not your fault. But what we trained by that dominant narrative, that imperial narrative, we do ask the question when somebody gets into debt and gets into trouble, what did that person do? And usually the answer is, how can we help them figure out how to make this work? Even though it's not so much what the person did. I mean, yes, you're involved in it, but it's not just that. It's not just that simple. But the dominant song, Empire's song, if we're done with the Lord's song, Empire's song is, this thing works, it works well, and if it's not working for you, that's on you. It's your fault, exactly. And there's enough truth in it. I signed the thing for the credit card. You know, I took the credit card out, and there's enough truth in it that you can feel that way. It's really easy to feel that way. But you know, when 20 to 30 million people are out of work in this country, that's not 20 to 30 million people messing up. That's a system that's not working. When there is $11.85 trillion of household debt, this isn't, you know, this isn't government debt or anything. This is household debt between houses and student loans and credit card debt. That is not $11.85 trillion worth of people making mistakes. That's a system that is not working. So Empire can keep singing that song, but we have to start saying, wait a minute, that song is a lie. There is something wrong with Empire's song. And there's another song that's worth singing. So let me remind you of the Exodus story, the story that brings up Jubilee. You know, and again, remembering Father Allen's question, what is it you hope to be liberated from? Exodus story, Pharaoh has an economy of fear. Remember the dream about you know, the animals dying and all that kind of stuff, and how there's not going to be enough food to eat, so he starts hoarding things up and saving things up, and that becomes the practice of Exodus. But in order for that thing to work, there have to be slaves to build the storehouses and make it work. And God says, that's not okay with me, and calls slaves, the Israelites, out of Egypt and out of slavery and out of that economy of scarcity and fear and into a new way of life, in which they can rest one day in seven instead of working 7 days, and things will still get done. In which the food on the edges of the field don't have to be sort of gathered up and saved for some future time, but can be left for the people who need it now. A new kind of economy in which debts are forgiven every 7 years, and every seven times 7 years, all that wealth that's been accumulated, kind of, it goes back and it gets spread out, the land and everything. And slaves are free, and no one becomes too rich, and no one becomes too poor. And you don't have to hoard, because you know that the God that you worship and who runs the world will give you every day the bread that you need for that day. That's our song. That's our song. And this idea was carried out and sometimes lived well and sometimes not lived so well, but always held as an ideal for centuries, always there. And Jesus claimed it as his mission, as, you know, in Luke 4. That's our song. And that's the song, I think, that in Jubilee we're trying to learn to sing. Even though we're living in this strange land that's got all kinds of other songs. It's a beautiful song. But because we hear Empire's song over and over 24/7, it's hard to even remember our song. And because we're so beat down by Empire's song, it's hard to sing that Lord's song at all. You're captive to Empire and to Empire's economy. And Empire's song rings in our ears. But in this movement, we're trying to learn another song. We're trying to sing the Lord's song in this very strange land. Thank you.